From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted.
Firstborn by David Compton. There were questions to be answered. As the gale hurled more snow at the window of Harry's cottage, I asked myself what I was doing here. The pure malt I sipped was hardly the answer. The local product made a visit to this ice-raked wilderness bearable, but I wasn't here for the whiskey. To be honest, I had hoped that since coming into his late uncle's thousands, Harry might be good for another touch. Otherwise, when he suggested the jaunt, I might not have so willingly traded civilization for cold quarters in a converted barn. But what was a hothouse plant like Harry doing in the highest of the highlands anyway? Moreover, Harry's elegant Elaine was here, too, in this croft north of Inverness. Why? At this time of all times in a woman's life, surely persons of substance expect their firstborn to be delivered with all the advantages of modern obstetrics, instead of which Elaine, who at a pinch could always make do with the best, was holding her breath in the whitewashed bedroom next to us, while the local midwife did whatever local midwives do. The atmosphere was charged with unvoiced questions. At a sharp cry from the next room, Harry paused in mid-glass. The Scottish tones of the midwife's response, half-chiding, half-reassuring, were muffled by the closed door. Harry opened his mouth, but only managed a creak from the back of his throat. The expectant father's face shone in the light of the stoked-up fire. His eyes tried to focus on objects beyond the flicker of the leaping flames. He wanted to talk, and only needed enough scotch in him to flush out the words. At last he plunged. "Trust you, Jerry," he mumbled. "Hope so." Detecting a certain lack of conviction in his tone, I hastened to reassure him. "After all, I owe so much to you." The literal truth, all those IOUs. This comfort induced a wry smile. "That's why it has to be you. Here, I mean, in case." He tossed another log onto the fire. "First, you ought to know about... not fair to face you with... Of course, it might not after all, in which case there's no harm. But if it should be necessary..." He kicked the log, sending a burst of sparks up the chimney. Had I betrayed signs of uneasiness? He patted my shoulder and paced from wall to wall of the tiny room. 4 steps each way. "That's why we're out here in the wilds, of course. Nobody else to... The midwife's a risk, but money's a great persuader, I nodded agreement over the rim of my glass. "How else did the old boy coax us down to Dorset?" he went on. "Money called. Elaine didn't even query the social life in Dorset, which meant that even she understood the situation. The wolves were gathering. You're familiar with the signs, bills in red with great threatening stamps all over them, phone dead, supplies cut off, friends suddenly out of town. At the clink of Uncle's money bags, we packed little we had to pack and accepted what he offered without leaving a forwarding address for our creditors. Uncle must have heard a whisper of our little local difficulties, but that didn't explain this uncharacteristic generosity. True, I was his surviving nearest and dearest, but until then he'd hardly acknowledge my existence. I didn't believe his guff about being lonely. He'd lived alone all his life, and, being past the 70 mark, must have been used to his own company. For 40 or more years he devoted himself to making money in the city with a ruthless single-mindedness that ruled out friends. He may have had an acquaintance or two at one time, but almost certainly threw them to the sharks whenever profit was involved. Uncle loved uncle and money, which didn't leave much affection over for anyone else, not even my beautiful Elaine. He asked specifically for Elaine, obviously, in some way or another. We were expected to sing for our suppers, but a straw looks like a lifeboat to a drowning man. Dorset was the promised land. Uncle had built a place there just over a year before. Between retirement and moving into this retreat, he had lived abroad. He never mentioned those years to us. Whatever we learned about them, we gleaned from another source. The architect of the new building must have been utterly undistinguished, as not a single aspect of it was designed to catch the eye. The more remarkable features had been added to my uncle's own specifications, and we were only to learn about them in due course. His home was distant enough from civilization to satisfy a demanding recluse. The taxi fare from the station took away my breath and all but a jingle of small change. I suppose it was typical of the very rich that Uncle never considered reimbursing our traveling expenses. So there we were on his doorstep, like orphans at Barnato's, dependent on his charitable whims. Oddly, we felt neither downcast nor apprehensive. Sunshine helped. Remember last May's early heat wave? Although the house was nothing to write home about, the garden was a delight. Bees were busily doing whatever bees are supposed to do, and the flowers were encouraging them. Their scent would have been worth a fortune in a bottle. Elaine seemed to think so too. She paused halfway up the garden path, nose twitching and an expression of silly bliss on her face. That slight indulgence gave Uncle time to establish himself on the front porch with welcoming gestures. He was an undersized monkey of a man, whose grin stretched from ear to ear, exposing an unconvincing set of teeth. His bright eyes twinkled like frost. Obviously, we measured up to his expectations, Elaine particularly. He fondled her hand in both his shriveled paws and stood on tiptoe to kiss her cheek. His enthusiasm over how much he was going to enjoy having us with him had a ring of the double entendre. As Elaine's eyes met mine over his wrinkled head, she raised a questioning brow. I replied with a reassuring smile. Whatever lecherous impulses my superannuated relative may have harbored, he was surely past exercising them. After which we were introduced to the guest room, then given lunch. The appointments were new and luxurious. I suspected they had been ordered specifically for us. The food was as good as deep freeze and microwave could rise to. The wine was excellent. I had a feeling that Elaine was going to be happy for a while. Between meals, she was able to stretch out, suitably anointed, on the green velvet lawn, exposing herself to the sun, her gleaming skin tanning to the caramel that blended so well with her butterscotch hair. I caught Uncle licking his lips like a small boy at a sweet shop window. Well, age can have few compensations, and who was I to intrude on this naughty fantasies? I had daydreams of my own. I had plenty of time for them, too. The house, equipped with every modern labor saver, more or less ran itself while Uncle pottered among his plants. In spite of his initial pressing invitation, the old boy paid far more attention to his seedlings than to his guests. He presided over meals and presumed that concluded his duties as a host. His concentration on the paraphernalia of propagation almost amounted to mania. As an ancient is entitled to his eccentricities, I left him to them. By the third day, though, boredom had led me to the greenhouses. We hadn't been warned that they were out of bounds. When I tried one of the doors and it wouldn't open, I assumed it was merely stuck. I was just heaving on the handle when Uncle bounded up shrieking. I didn't exactly quail, because I'm not the quailing sort, but I must have looked somewhat blasted, because he suddenly cut his wrath short and apologized, giving me the monkey grin with nothing behind it but teeth. On my side, I agreed that botanical experiments can be a sensitive area, and on his side he promised a guided tour of the potting sheds. While I'm fond enough of fruit and flowers on the table, I've never been one for prying into their private lives. However, I had nothing better to do, and as our comfort depended on keeping Uncle sweet, I trailed behind, playing up an interest I didn't exactly feel. The first greenhouse was all orchids. Some were pretty, some were bizarre. Uncle explained that he had started with orchids. While still in the full vigor of his late 50s, piling thousands upon thousands, his medical had advised him to take up a hobby. Preparing for retirement, he called it. Orchids were one of the suggestions. The doctor should have known that my uncle was incapable of doing anything by halves. Orchids became a consuming passion. Retiring years before he was expected to, actually shaking the FT share index, the relative devoted himself to his new pursuit. He embraced orchidomania as fervently as a religion. New horizons opened up. He had hoped one day to cultivate. Had I read Wells' Flowering of the Strange Orchid? A pity that one had eluded him, because orchids now commanded less of his time. He reached beyond orchids. We left the orchid house. The orchid house was not locked. Making a detour through the kitchen, we picked up a basin full of mints, a slice or two of steak, and a couple of bones. There was a mortise lock on the door of the next hot house. Thin brown fingers clutching the key, my uncle swore me to secrecy. I made some feeble joke, but pandered to his whims. Even then, before opening the door, he delivered a mini-lecture on his current obsession. The thin line between plant and animal life. The man-eating vine was a common place of horror stories. Well, there was an area for fantasy fiction merged with fantastic fact. The plants nearest the door were almost commonplace. If giant flytraps and sundews can be counted as commonplace, we fed these with pinches of mints. I was even allowed the treat of sprinkling meat onto waiting flowers. I admit, I found the reaction grimly fascinating, with some blooms snapping shut on dinner and others curling tendrils over their morsels of protein. Uncle enjoyed himself almost as much as the plants. The larger specimens were more impressive. They were approached with a certain reverence. You have to accord respect to any vegetation that can make a meal of half a pound of steak. I wasn't allowed to feed these, nor did I wish to. I felt that unless approached with care, one of them might snap off a finger as an hors d'oeuvre. Something crawled towards my neck, and I put a cautious hand up to it. It was no more than a trickle of sweat. The temperature and humidity in the glass house was uncomfortably high. Uncle grinned as he noticed the gesture, but he didn't comment. Instead, he continued his exposition on South American discoveries, coupled with research into hybrids, grafting, cross-fertilization, and so on, all mixed up with a polysyllabic jargon that bemused me completely. Although I couldn't understand what he was talking about, I could see what he was doing. We ended by confronting an unhealthy-looking mass with blotched, saucer-like leaves, or were they blooms? By this time, most of the meat had been consumed, the other plants devoted to the process of digestion. Uncle had only bloody bones left in his tuck box. Were they for this mottled monster? Of course they were. I believe the thing was quivering with expectation. It practically grabbed at the hunks of skin and bone, my uncle musing meanwhile on whether the thing was capable of consuming a man. Not whole, he concluded, answering his own queries. A man would have to be chopped up first, and that hardly counted. However, his researches were continuing. He had entered an area of delicate and fascinating speculation. Was the question now one of cultivation or of breeding? Was conception the dividing line between animal and vegetable? Could that line be crossed? One of the saucers opened with a plop and a nauseating reek of gas. I'll swear it burped. Uncle suggested that I had seen enough for one day. I agreed with him. My shirt was sticking to my back. My soggy condition had nothing to do with either the temperature or the humidity. Outside in the sunshine, Elaine was tanning prettily. She purred contentedly as I rubbed oil between her shoulder blades. But Uncle's references to breeding had touched me on a sore spot. The fact is, Elaine and I had experienced some difficulty in that department. It seemed that I couldn't, and she didn't want to. At least, not often. I don't know whether I couldn't because she didn't want to, or whether she didn't want to because I couldn't. As a sex symbol, Elaine was all symbol and no sex, none of which had escaped Uncle's beady eye. In fact, at mealtime, the only occasion on which the three of us seemed to come together, he would slip into the conversation occasional innuendos or half-jokes, meant to be funny because accompanied by a wrinkled grimace, but which I considered in rather poor taste. Naturally, I didn't wince as I felt inclined, because a poor relation learns to laugh at the right times. Well, I suppose the old devil eventually did us a good turn. After a particularly good dinner, I can't recall what we ate, but the claret was remarkable. Uncle had been holding forth on his monomania. As a dutiful nephew, I displayed some interest, and Elaine bestowed the occasional slow, sweet smile. Elaine has never been a great wit, being too involved with her private thoughts to follow much conversation. But her smile has warmed the cockles of many a monolinguist's heart. She and I toyed relaxedly with our brandy snifters, content to let Uncle sparkle like the soda water in his glass. On this occasion, the bubbles must have gone to his head, because he prattled of his great experiment. At first, I took this to mean the bone-crunching monster locked up in the hothouse, but gradually came to realize that he was referring to some holy of holies. Apparently, under the house lay unsuspected cellars, and he was offering to show us all. Elaine and I floated after him on an alcoholic cloud of euphoria. The cellar door was a cunningly devised panel in the kitchen. At the bottom of the stairs were doors to right and left. Behind the right-hand door lay the wine racks, and an electronically controlled atmosphere at exactly the right temperature and humidity to keep their precious contents in condition. The same principle applied to the room behind the left-hand door, except that here conditions were equatorial. Within minutes of the door being shut behind us, our pores had opened like faucets, sweat running into our eyes. Even with vision somewhat blurred, though, we could not miss the vine that half-filled the cellar. The plant was supported by a frame of hawsers to which it clung like rope-like tendrils. As Uncle lectured on instinctive reactions in plants, he held out a finger and a green thread obligingly curled around it. A pretty demonstration. While we were admiring this performance, I leaned unsteadily against the frame, whereupon something gripped me around the waist in a wrestler's hold, jerking me off my feet and among the dripping leaves. Uncle gently unwound the slippery bonds, clucking words like naughty, naughty, though I could not be sure whether they applied to me or to the vine. Cautiously standing back, we were invited to admire the buds that festooned the branches, green fingers varying in size, with the largest a hand span in length and over an inch in diameter. Streaks of red showed through a tracery of cracks near the top of one bud that was ready to open. Subdued excitement gripped Uncle. He knew what to expect. He stared at the bud, biting his lip and breathing heavily, on cue while we watched the bud burst open. Later I wondered if the fact that we were there may have had something to do with this prompt exhibition. After all, the movement of the tendrils had shown that the plant reacted to our presence. Even if we had been obliged to wait, though, we would have been rewarded by the display. The flower was remarkable. A bright shining red, it parodied my inefficient reproductive equipment, the main difference being its rampant vigor compared with my habitual ineptitude. No wonder it had been kept behind locked doors. Its appearance in a shop window might have exposed a florist to prosecution under the Obscene Publications Act. Elaine had a delicate mind. Easily offended by schoolboy smut, she switches off completely at an off-color remark. I glanced sideways, expecting blushes at one of nature's jokes. In that heat, a blush was difficult to detect, but her eyes had opened very wide and her mouth hung open. For the space of a few heartbeats, nothing existed in her world but that flower. She looked so peculiarly vulnerable that something stirred deep inside me. A chemical reaction with pity and jealous fizzing together. I wanted to take her in my arms and console her for what she had been missing, at the same time realizing, almost with fury, that in her present mood she would be easy game for anyone offering as much. The show was not yet over. My uncle giggled as he tapped the stem of the flower. It bounced backwards and forwards suggestively, and before quivering to a stop it exuded a few drops of viscous honeydew with a heady perfume. I can't describe the scent, only its effect, more potent than any combination of claret and brandy. Elaine felt it too. The melting ice maiden turned to me moist-lipped. Her hair was streaming. Perspiration and the atmosphere had drenched her clothes until they clung to every curve. She was making little animal noises. Dizzy with the perfume, I grabbed her, and she clung to me. Murmuring incoherent excuses to my uncle, we lunged from the cellar. I dimly remember him holding the cellar door open for us, and his laughter cackling behind us. We left a trail of scattered garments all the way up the stairs to our bedroom. From then on, we threshed about in an ecstatic frenzy until first light, when sheer exhaustion brought us down to earth, and we crashed into sleep. Harry fell silent, savoring his drink and perhaps the memory. We could hear the midwife purposely busy. Harry gestured vaguely in her direction with his glass, as though emphasizing the link between the drama in the next room and the bedroom farce some 9 months past. "Good for Uncle's potted plants," I murmured, quickly refilling my glass before the bottle was quite empty. Between the glow of the fire, the sighing of the wind, and Harry's reminiscent drawl, I was losing a battle against lethargy. Another cry from Elaine. I sat up with an expletive, and with one stride Harry was over to the door. It opened as he reached it. The freckled midwife, firm of bosom and bicep, shook her head. "Early yet," she hooted. "Back to your bottle and then fast yourself. I promise you'll be the first in ken when the Baron appears." She disappeared, shutting the bedroom door with the speed and efficiency of a cuckoo returning to its clock. Harry ambled back to his chair, nursed his empty glass for a minute, then began to talk again. It passed the time. "That wasn't the only occasion," he went on. "She'd come panting to bed, eager as a wild colt for a gallop, and I'd know it had been blossom time again. Luckily, some of that perfume seemed to cling to her. Her fingers would be covered with red pollen. One sniff and I'd be bucking like a bronco. At first, after these bouts, we'd go back to our old sterile ways, but gradually we began to grow towards each other. Nothing madly shattering, of course, but at least giving us a new interest in life. I'm more grateful to Uncle for that than for his thousands." More silence from Harry. "A sudden bereavement?" I hazarded. He sighed, as Adam might have sighed, looking back on lost paradise. "It was the onion cellar," he said simply. I waited for what must follow. Uncle was undisturbable down in the cellar, and Elaine was soaking up the ultraviolet when the onion cellar appeared at the kitchen door. He was a slight man, kippered by wind and sun. Little black eyes had taken in every item of kitchen equipment between his question and my reply. In point of fact, he only seemed to know one word, which was onions. As easy one, because it's almost the same in French as in English. I replied, "No," showing off a bit, waving a hand at the deep freeze, the microwave oven, and the washing-up machine, conveying the information that food in these parts was practically untouched by human hand. We just didn't need much items as old-fashioned onions. So off he trundled, bundles of onions swinging from his shoulders. He had a poor sense of direction because, instead of turning towards the front gate, he'd headed for the greenhouses. I had to swim around and point him in the direction he ought to go. He paused before going on to his next customer and looked back at the house. Not casual as one does at a gate, but intently as though searching for something which ought to have been there that he'd missed. I remember telling myself that the poor bastard wasn't going to do much business in this area with at least 2 miles between us and the next house. Then I went on to consider he must have been pretty stupid, because even an unlettered clod must have seen there was no other house down this lane, and no houses meant no sales. Finally, I recalled that I hadn't seen an onion seller for years. He was an anachronism, like a muffin man ringing his bell round Earl's Court. By way of pleasantry, I mentioned this to Uncle halfway through dinner that evening. He didn't find my joke very funny. In fact, it put him off his food. He sat down his knife and fork very precisely, cogitated for a count of 40, then fired a stream of questions at me like an interrogating commissar. He wanted to be told exactly what the man had looked like, exactly what he had said, every detail of time, place, and scenario, until he knew as much about the encounter as if he'd been there. When all that information had been gathered in, he pushed abruptly from the table and whisked from the room without waiting for coffee, muttering something that sounded like, "Now, now, now." He spent the rest of the night down in the cellar. He surfaced halfway through the following morning, just as I was massaging suntan oil into that awkward spot halfway up Elaine's spine. He wanted her assistance with a tricky process below stairs. Knowing Elaine's limitations whenever anything practical is involved, I offered my services but was brushed aside. Uncle wanted Elaine, and Elaine alone. I fastened her halter top and retired gracefully. My meditations were interrupted by the return of the onion seller, this time without the pretense of onions. In the 24 hours since our last encounter, vocabulary had improved remarkably. He still had a marked foreign accent, but expressed himself forcefully. Making inquiries in the neighborhood, he had been informed that an old gentleman lived alone on these premises. Encountering me yesterday, he had assumed he must have taken a wrong turn. However, a conversation last night with a taxi driver convinced him that he had been right first time. He wanted my uncle. What's more, the expression on his face and the tone of his voice did not encourage me to call for the old man. Fortunately, the cellar door was closed, and the stranger's darting glances failed to spot the vital panel. However, my formal reply that uncle was not at home to callers was clearly not believed. The bright black eyes came to rest almost lovingly on a gleaming butcher's cleaver hanging with other equipment on the kitchen wall. I don't know why it was there. I'd never seen it in action. The foreigner, though, was obviously considering a use for it. Suddenly, he changed his tactics. With a smile, intended to be warm and friendly, he promised Monsieur that if Monsieur knew anything, Monsieur would understand everything, and if the worst came to worst, perhaps even forgive everything. It was a long story, but it did not interrupt because, while the chap was talking, he was not molesting Uncle. My main fear was that Uncle himself might come popping out in the middle of the narrative. Luckily, he didn't. It seemed that in his own village, the onion seller once had a son, black hair, black eyes, and a lithe body brown as a nut. In the boy's 13th year, an old man had come to live nearby. This old man was rich enough to indulge his hobby of raising peculiar plants. Some of these could only have been conceived by the devil, but the boy was fascinated. As months passed, he began to spend all his spare time in the hellish garden created by the Englishman. He was occasionally paid for doing odd jobs, not overpaid because the very rich understand the value of money, but money changed hands. Because of the money, rumor started, but there was no truth in those stories. Truly, those two were not interested in each other, but only in the loathsome specimens. The boy was warned to stay away, but he defied authority, even enduring beatings. There came a time when the boy did not come home at all. His father went up to the house of the crazy plants, intent on a reckoning. The old man had suddenly decamped. The boy was there, though. The stranger's voice was flat and unemotional, had he described how the young body had been found tangled with a vine. Quite dead, of course. What else could have been expected? After being impaled, did Monsieur understand? A great shoot of the plant had been thrust up inside the victim. Tendrils of the vine had held him fast while he perished in agonies. That thing inside him. The man could spin a yarn. I slumped back on the kitchen stool as he helped himself to the cleaver. After that, I was quick to take evasive action, putting the length of a table between myself and that shining steelware. I fancy I babbled something about not being responsible for my relation's misdeeds. However, the cleaver was not required for immediate bloodletting, only for breaking the windows of accursed greenhouses. I didn't try to stop him. After all, glass is replaceable. I am not. A minute or so later, I heard a crashing and tinkling like a mad comedy act. My next inclination was to brief Uncle on these developments. It says something for the intruder's narrative powers that, until I opened the cellar door, all my attention had been focused on the poor devil's sufferings. Only when I stood at the top of the stairs did I begin to put two and two together. I didn't like the total. Uncle was down there with Elaine and the vine. I was soon down there too, quicker than I had intended because I missed my footing and bounced half the way, but I didn't feel the bruises. Scrambling to my feet, I crashed open the double door. Thank heavens the old devil had been so sure of my behaving myself he hadn't troubled to lock it. The first thing to hit me was the perfume, now so concentrated it had passed beyond sweetness into a stink. The vine, covered with red blooms, might have been dripping blood. Elaine was spread-eagled over it, tendrils binding her body in a St. Andrew's cross. Her head drooped. She was unconscious. I hurtled over to her and tried to pull her free. Uncle did his feeble best to stop me, but I sent him spinning with a well-aimed if unsupporting kick to the groin. He needn't have bothered because before I realized what was happening, the vine had got me too, and I was struggling with a thick green coil around my middle. Uncle and I screamed obscenities at each other. I won that round on points, because in barbed phrases I described what was happening upstairs to the rest of his collection. He howled like a creature possessed and fled, leaving me to wrestle on. The plant had an unfair advantage. I had only two arms and two legs, whereas it seemed to produce fresh thongs at will. My resistance grew weaker as it bound me firmly to itself. Was all that an inbuilt natural reaction, or did it have a mind of its own? I lost count of time, but eventually felt a cool draught on my face and realized that the heavy scent was drifting away. In his hurry, Uncle had left both doors open. The grip of one of the tendrils relaxed, and I was able to free a hand. Slowly, I disengaged myself. I don't know whether the sudden drop in temperature was affecting the plant, or whether, having done what it was intended to do, it would have died anyway. Once I had disentangled myself, I released Elaine. As I lowered her to the cellar door, her eyelids fluttered. At least she was still alive. Filled with hot fury against the monsters that had treated her with this indignity, I fell upon the vine, tearing great bunches of flowers from it. By now it was a defenseless object, visibly wilting, and eventually I realized that I would be better employed in rendering my uncle limb from limb. It says something for the incoherence of my reasoning that I left Elaine lying there while I surfaced, calling down damnation on that gibbering little ape. I found parts of him in the ruins of the carnivore's hothouse. The onion cellar had fed the rest to various plants. On seeing me, the boy's father smiled, bowed, and walked away. The police caught up with him on the outskirts of Poole, indisputably insane. He was never brought to trial. None of the plants survived. A chap from the botanical garden at Kew was quite cut up about that. Not as cut up as Uncle, of course. Fortunately, there was enough left of him for identification in a respectable funeral. Silence again, except for the wind and the snow. "Is that all?" I asked after a while. "I don't know," replied Harry. "You see, when I'd calmed down somewhat and had Elaine properly sedated and tucked up in bed, something was found." "Something?" I prompted after another long silence. Where Elaine had been lying, a long, limp, dirty brown object, rather like a flabby bean pod, only it had never had beans in it. "What was it?" Harry took a deep breath and was about to answer when he stopped. In the next room, the midwife had started to scream.